and shivering. He had a belt about a mile long stretching around his belly, as if he thought his pants could actually fall down. It was impossible, they were so tight. He always stared at me like he was planning to gobble me up. Daisy was gone. They couldn't find her. It was 4 in the morning. Actually, Randall said, she hasn't been home for 2 days. Mrs. Foote was having a fit. The flab on her arms was quivering even when the rest of her was quiet. May said, "Sit down, Dee Dee. Here's some whiskey. You just steady yourself. We'll find her." May spoke in a way that made us all believe her. May would make it come right, make no mistake. Randall kept saying he was going to murder Daisy when she got home for driving his mother hysterical, because Mr. Foote's kidneys were on the blink. Randall acted like a big old rooster watching over his brood of bad girls. May called the sheriff and the rev while she poured drinks for Mrs. Foote. May was such a good friend to share her alcohol. Mrs. Foote got loaded on the whiskey, so May put her to bed on the couch. She told Randall to use the recliner. When they woke up about 10 the next morning, Daisy was in our kitchen eating cereal. Daisy wouldn't say much. She told Randall to lay off her. There was something she said about a trucker down at the truck stop near the highway, and how she went clear to Kentucky with him. Chapter 7. Once I got out of high school, where I didn't learn a thing because I dreamt about blind tapes the whole time, I went to work where May worked. I kept trying to keep my eye on the world so I could get to it sometime. I wasn't sure how I was going to get there without money or wits. I spent all my energy keeping track of dirty clothes and chickens and all the eggs, every day more eggs. I had dreams where I was shredding newspaper and wadding it into balls to stuff up the hens' bottoms, stop them from laying for a while. Still, I knew the world was out there, another country, with an ocean between us. It was right around my commencement when Miss Finch had to go to a nursing home. I didn't say goodbye to her. Her family came and packed her up and took her to a place full of old people strapped into wheelchairs, screaming about the 1920s. It was the Baptist home, where May's Aunt Margaret had gone. So May was an expert on the subject. She said that in that place people die in bunches. There'll be a dry spell for months, and then 3 or 4 will go in the space of 24 hours. Before she left, Miss Finch was forgetting everything I told her. She didn't want to hear any more books. They made her so tired, she said. When I went over in the afternoon, she was already angry with me. She'd say, "Where's my lunch? I'm so hungry. Why don't they bring me lunch?" She'd pout and then whimper. I had to take her hands and make her feel her empty lunch tray by her bed. I tried to make her remember the Jell-O with the bananas in it, but she said I was pulling the wool over her eyes. "Miss Finch," I said, "don't tell me I'm a liar." I had to cry about her lost brain. I took her hands and put them on my wet face and whispered, "Say I'm beautiful, okay? Remember the islands you went to with your husband?" I said about 100 times each visit. "Yes, I do, clear as a bell, my dear. That sweet, warm blue water, clear as a bell." She could remember the details about the islands, but what escaped her was, did she actually eat lunch? And who was I again? I wanted her to at least think of the books she loved. I tried to jostle her thoughts by saying, "Wouldn't it be great if Mr. Darcy walked in here?" He was our favorite out of all the people on her blind tapes. She was always saying, "Yes, yes," but she wasn't actually recalling. She was only saying yes, like a little dog thinking it might get a snack if it did the right trick. I watched from our house when they came to take her. It was a silent parade of people and suitcases. Then, when they were gone, I sat on our steps, just sat, thinking over the years I knew Miss Finch, thinking of all the afternoons we spent together. I sat there until it got dark. I sat through May calling me for supper 3 times. I was living in the books Miss Finch gave me. I couldn't believe how lucky I was to have had her for a friend. I couldn't believe how much I was going to miss her blind eyes looking at me with all their tenderness. Matt and I graduated at the same time because we were in the class of 73 together. He didn't get anything but A's for 4 years straight, so he made the speech. The girls were supposed to be dressed entirely in white, without flashy jewelry, and the boys had on black suits. We carried a couple of red roses in our arms, but when I sniffed them, they smelled old, as if they had been piled up in a grocery store for a few weeks. Our school probably got them cheap. I went into shock when the words began flowing from Matt's mouth, because I hadn't heard him say a complete sentence in 10 years. He was exemplary, everything a person could wish for in a graduate, except for that complexion of his. He probably broke out because he was nervous, standing up there in front of hundreds of people he didn't like. He knew a great deal of information. He talked about wars we were withdrawing from. He didn't mention any particular place. He probably didn't want to get into trouble with the country. But he did say that wars resulted from the foolish work of the government and that our president would have it on his conscience. He talked about corruption in the highest places, that it was time for new leadership. "This is Matt," I kept saying to myself. And that we were trying to be an honest generation. He said he was going to go to college and work to make peace through science. He said that peace was something everyone in our class had to work for, because we lived in a dangerous age. I could tell some of the parents out there in the audience, shifting around, didn't appreciate Matt bad-mouthing the president. I guess commencement speeches usually outline a brilliant future. They don't mention H-bombs that could fall on us and char the little children. I kept looking at Matt, at the back of his head, while he spoke. And I thought to myself, he's my brother. I couldn't believe that I grew up in the same house with him. We knew nothing about each other. If he said anything in my presence, it was to tell me I was a moron. He stood up on stage informing everyone in the town about his plans to make peace on Earth with the technology stored in the cavity of his head. And when he got home that night, he would, as usual, call his sister a moron, with his eyes, not his voice. I had a tremendous urge. I was going to burst if I didn't stand up in the spiky white heels May bought for me and scream to everyone there. I could even see the Rev, "Go to hell, every single last bastard!" I was going to march down to the microphone, grab it from Matt's smooth, freckled hands, and tell the parents the F-word. I was going to turn to Matt and demand that he take me with him when he left Honey Creek. I had to clamp my hands to my chair to make myself sit rigid and not go clumping in my heels to the podium. I had to take deep breaths so I wouldn't spontaneously combust. May appointed herself guest of honor because she had made Matt with his fine round face and his clean fingernails. Everyone congratulated her, and she smiled vaguely, as if she were saying, "My boy has been a genius for so long. Why are you shaking my hand now?" Daisy graduated also. It was common knowledge that she passed English because Mr. Davidson craved her every inch. He was too shy to take her out, but so in love he forgave her for not turning in her themes. At the ceremony, she wore a dress that had holes punched out of it in rows all around her stomach, as if they were windows on a ship. She wore green fingernail polish to match her eyelids, and contrary to instructions, green plastic earrings the size of $0.50. Everyone's heart raced when she pranced across the stage, chewing her gum. She was tall and dark and cared for no one. To me, she looked like Mr. Darcy's twin sister. In the book Miss Finch and I read, Pride and Prejudice, Mr. Darcy didn't have a twin sister. But you never know. He could have had one they were ashamed of. I had always tried to get in gym class with Daisy so I could see her in the shower, but we were never on the same schedule. She winked at me and waved her diploma when she climbed the risers to find her seat. Her look made the fur on my back stand up all prickly. Afterwards, Randall shook my hand and said, "Best wishes." He had his little change purse in his clutches. He always carried that thing around with him, as if he thought he was living in some fairy tale where he, the king, has a purse of gold. Randall wasn't my favorite person of all time. He made me want to run away from the sight of his shirt coming out of his pants. Sometimes, when he sat on a stool in our kitchen, if he was straining to reach the potato chips, his pants, even though they were tight, slipped down. You could see his crack. Mrs. Foote asked May if we wanted to go out with the Foote family, not counting the mister, who was in the hospital hooked up to a kidney machine. May looked at Mrs. Foote as if she'd never laid eyes on her before and said, "We have other engagements." She had her nose in the air as she turned her back. Mrs. Foote was only stupefied for an instant, and then she remembered that people always treated her like that. She walked slowly away on her stumpy legs. She didn't even put her headscarf on to keep the rain from ruining the permanent May gave her, the hairdo that made Mrs. Foote look like a bald baby who has one curl on top of its head. It was true, we did have an invitation to go out for ice cream with Mr. Hansen and a few of the other graduates with brains and their parents. Still, in front of all the people at graduation, May had to make it absolutely clear that she was far too good for the Foots. I would have been happy to be on a date with Randall compared to the company of the smart graduates in that one single terrible hour at the ice cream parlor. I'm eating my chocolate sundae as fast as I possibly can in the white dress May borrowed from Mrs. Foote. It's plain, except for the puffy short sleeves and a scoop neck, and drops of chocolate running down the front. The salted pecans and the hot fudge don't even taste good, but I don't know what else to do except eat. I wish I was a black hole that was swirling through space, suctioning up brilliant young stars. When Dr. Hecht, principal asked me, "What are you planning to do, young lady, now that you're out of high school?" And he pats my diploma. I say, turning red like May's lobster hands, I say fast, "I'm gonna go work at the dry cleaners." Nobody makes one sound. Matt is wishing an elephant would come over, hook its trunk around me, and carry me off. I can see all of them thinking, how in the world did one family turn out a genius ready to make peace on earth and a dry cleaner's employee? I have the urge again. It's so fierce in me to stand up and tell how Matt got a head start because he talked practically the day of his birth and because May was crazy about boy babies. He got all the new clothes from Sears. I want to scream that I'm possibly just as smart as any one of them, except Matt. I want to ask each graduate if they can name all the characters Charles Dickens ever wrote about. Then I bet their faces wouldn't gloat too long. I can't think about the ice cream parlor without feeling my face heat up with humiliation. In those days, I didn't have an ounce of gumption. I only dreamed about standing up and telling Dr. Hecht, "Go to hell," because I knew if I did, I'd get put in the clinker, or May would blindfold me and drop me off on someone's doorstep where she delivered eggs. Matt told all the ignorant parents what he was going to study when he got to MIT out on the East Coast. It wasn't a secret that the college was paying for him to come and learn science concepts. Diane Crawford was going to be out there too, at Smith College. Dr. Hecht made some crazy remark about Diane and Matt getting together in Boston to talk about their alma mater in old times. Diane almost gagged on her cherry. She was probably planning never to think of Honey Creek again once she got beyond the town limits. When I got home, I looked at a map to see where Boston was located. It didn't look so far away. only I knew it was 1,000 miles away. So distant, I couldn't imagine the length of those miles. Right after graduation, Matt went off to another one of his summer camps. He lived in a dormitory in New York City and did his math. He got money for doing it. He was probably rich. He never sent May a nickel. He sent her one postcard of the Empire State Building, and that's when I knew Matt was gone for good, as I had predicted. And what's left is May and me in our house, and the job at the dry cleaners. Mrs. Foote came over the day after graduation, and she and May picked up right where they left off. I could hear May saying, "It'll be all right, Dee Dee. It'll work out good, you'll see." So there May and I are at the dry cleaners, just at the edge of Stillwater on Highway 12, trying not to breathe. I remember nothing about the early days except the smell. The smell got into your heart, and your heart pumped poison all over you, up into your brain, so everyone you looked at appeared gray. Still, I thought it might be awfully nice to be a clean coat underneath the plastic, an orange ticket saying you belong to somebody. The trim and tidy dry cleaners is a low, square, white stucco building with glass windows so you can look out and see the trucks going by. Trim and tidy. It sounds like the perfect place to be. It'd be funny if that's what the planet Earth were called. There were rows and rows of plastic bags with coats and sweaters, dresses and blankets, men's suits and quilts, everything you could think of that attracted dirt. Every now and then, an idiotic girl brought in her bathing suit because it said dry clean only. May and I stood at the counter to take the clothes and weigh them and write up the tickets. It was the only place in about 4 towns for cleaning, so we got everybody's dirty, soiled, we were supposed to say, garments. After we weighed the clothes, we were to look them over and mark the spots, and take off the buttons that could get wrecked by the chemicals. Artie, he's the boss, and Louise, the steamer, and Deborah did the work in the back. There were enough clothes and trim and tidy to make a mountain for people to ski down. After the clothes were clean, May and I sewed the buttons back on, wrapped up the articles in plastic, and put the number stickers on so we would know who owned what. We were called the finishers. At first, I thought I'd never get used to the smell. You feel it in your veins. My breath smelled like dry cleaners. I could feel the odor in my mouth and on my teeth. I could taste it in my chicken soup from my thermos at lunch. I could feel that smell behind my eyeballs. I watched the trucks flashing by the window, taking pop and flour and hogs and junk to places far away. Maybe they were carrying Daisy to see the world, down in Kentucky. I stared at people's faces when they weren't paying attention to me, and I made up stories about their lives. I imagined how the elderly ladies with professional permanents and blue handbags lived alone in 3-story houses with their small dogs and their gardens. They were so prim when they came in to trim and tidy. They were doing their spring cleaning all year long, getting their blankets and curtains freshened up. They dabbed their runny eyes with immaculate white handkerchiefs. I watched the farmers come in with their wives. I watched them stand in the doorway, shuffling back and forth in their tall rubber boots. They smelled like cows. They were going to smell like cows even after they were dead. They didn't say anything. They looked big and dumb, like being with a herd their whole lives had made them mute. I saw the little children sniff at the air and turn up their noses. I saw all of Stillwater passing by. Nothing escaped my attention. If I didn't keep my hands busy, I had to think, here goes my life. I'm going to spend the rest of my days working at the trim and tidy. I couldn't stand thinking there wasn't anything more left for me, so I worked at a frantic pace to keep my mind still. There were a couple of times when I'd forget and May would bawl me out for not saying things such as, "Have a nice day." I laughed so hard to myself when she demanded I say, "Have a nice day." The Rev's words came to me, "The dung heap shall smile. The dung heap shall say, 'Have a nice day.'" I had to tell Aunt Sid about that one, May shouting, "You tell them customers to have a nice day." Aunt Sid wrote me and said I was resilient. I had to look the word up. It's something to do with my wanting to laugh at May when she tells me to say, "Have a nice day." Resilient. I liked being resilient because it sounded like a jewel glittering in the light. Mrs. Foote came into the dry cleaners when Artie, the boss, wasn't around. She must have known his schedule, because she always came in with her pack of cigarettes just after he left, and she and May chewed the fat while May bagged the clothes, and I washed the windows, swept up, waited on people. Mrs. Foote had information on everyone in Honey Creek and Stillwater. May would always say, "Is that right? You don't say." "My God, I can't believe it!" as if old Frank Wortman and his bum liver were the most fascinating news she'd ever heard about in her life. Sometimes Mrs. Foote told stories about Daisy. That's when I perked up my ears. I tried to move closer to her big empty mouth. She said Daisy had a boyfriend from way down in Peoria who bought her little tiny bathing suits. Mrs. Foote had found pictures of Daisy on a motorcycle with a strap as thin as a string bean around her. Ahem, ahem. I couldn't stop thinking about Daisy on a black metal bike with her legs spread apart, and all that dark hair around her face, and then the little strap. I could almost imagine how that motorcycle must have felt to her legs.
May and I both worked 5 days a week from 9 to 5 back then at Trim and Tidy. When we came home at night, May made supper while I went out to get water for the hens and collect the eggs. We got along. We were with each other so much we didn't have a choice. We had to be companions because we were all each of us had. That's not counting Mrs. Foote. When May did the grocery shopping on Saturday, she bought us movie magazines and the books that tell what's going on in the soap operas. And since we both smoked, she bought a carton of Newports. Mrs. Foote offered me a Camel once, and May didn't say anything, so I started smoking. Except for a couple of coughs, I did it expertly on the first try. I felt adult, only I wished I had a black holder, the kind Daisy used. May and I sat at the table after supper, and while I cleaned the eggs, she smoked and flipped through the magazines. She read me news flashes, slowly, about all the celebrities and their new dates. I liked hearing the stories, and at the end, May always held up the pictures so I could examine Farrah Fawcett's big teeth. I'd squint to see. I'd have to make comments like, "Wow, look at Liz Taylor's tits." We had to laugh over some of the stars' body parts. We were good friends then, May and I, in a certain way. Every fall I couldn't help missing the cows and going across to the pasture to hear them shuffling through the leaves. My first September, at Trim and Tidy, I came home and stank in my blood and bones. I had to go outside at the end of the day to feel the weak sun on my skin. I walked up to the plateau, knowing I wasn't a youngster anymore, because I was out in the workforce. I wondered why I went to school all those years, just so I could put clothes in plastic bags. Why I had undergone the torture of long division. Sometimes I couldn't figure it out, what all the living was for. I did know that I loved autumn even more than spring. There was something about it that made me feel fond and sad, the way the fields turned gold and all the wild apples dropped to the ground, smelling and wasting. The wind screeching around the house told me the year behind us was gone forever. You could see the animals in the woods and the farmers gathering up food for the winter to keep from dying. The men, dwarfed by their machinery, were doing their tasks so urgently, shelling corn by tractor light with pitch dark closing in. I walked out in the early morning to sniff the leaves burning and whisper words to the geese on their way south. I loved how they knew exactly where they were flying. On payday, I handed my check over to May, because she was the banker, and she gave me $5 or $10 she said I could keep for myself. She said that we were barely scraping by. The oil, the taxes, the food, the car were so expensive. I had a pink plastic pig Elmer gave me when I was 6, where I stuffed the dollar bills. Someday, when something enormous was going to happen to me, I'd need the money. That fall, Artie got me to join the Trim and Tidy Bowling League. He said I didn't need to know how. He was going to teach me. I mumbled, "Okay." I thought he might fire me if I said I didn't want to. Our team was made up of May, Artie, Deborah, Louise, and me. Sometimes Mrs. Foote came too. She told me I should call her Dee Dee, but I couldn't quite do that, so I called her nothing. I'd say, "Hi," and stop at that. She brought Randall along with his change purse. He needed loads of quarters to buy Biddle honey bars from the vending machines. He didn't bowl at all. He said he wasn't real athletic, and I murmured, "You can say that again." He got mad at me, so mad he bought a Three Musketeers and tore at it with his teeth right in front of me. I wanted to tell him, "Randall, you're fat and useless, and I hate the way you stare at me." But instead, I whispered my thoughts to myself, because probably somewhere in him he hated how he was. He hated his body. I saw the backs of his legs once when he was in shorts, and they were all dimpled like cottage cheese. Dee Dee tried to get Daisy to come along on the league, too, something to perhaps interest her a little. She came a couple of times. I couldn't help gaping at her. I couldn't help observing the way she walked up to take her turn, as if she knew everyone would wait all night for her to first spit on her hands and then hold them over the dryer and get her thumb in the hole just right and eyeball the pins. She shook her head so her curls flopped around, and then she licked her lips. When she held the ball in her hands, all I could see was a motorcycle and her legs, and the little bathing suit strings hardly covering her up. When we sat around waiting for our turn, she'd ask me how it was going, and I'd say, "Pretty good. I'm working with Ma down at the cleaners." Like she didn't already know that, because there we were in the cleaners bowling league. She must have thought I was short on marbles. When she made strikes, she said, "Hot shit," and rubbed her hands together. She always wore tight pants, and I was afraid her thighs might lose all their circulation and atrophy. I liked bowling because I was halfway decent at the sport. Matter of fact, I always scored the most points for our team. And May grinned at me through the haze of smoke. She was a lousy bowler, but she actually didn't seem to mind being the worst. She smoked her cigarettes and drank whiskey sours and danced around with a butt hanging out of her mouth. She danced in her bowling shoes and her nylons, plus her bowling outfit, her pink and white checkered pantsuit. She started to hack, too, because of all the nicotine she had in her poor, soiled lungs. She could produce a hoarse laugh just like some of the stars on Hollywood Squares. I see May, a pink dancing lady with a big old ball on her thumb, blowing smoke rings up to the ceiling. She sure made me laugh, and the beauty of it is she made herself laugh too. We were in our element back then, at the town lanes. Daisy said to me, "You bowl fantastic." It was my bowling skills that made her notice I was alive. If I had been a dud, she probably would never have spoken to me. She made me so happy I had to go outside and catch my breath. Right around Thanksgiving, Dee Dee's husband dropped dead. His kidneys gave out one morning, and he didn't wake up. They were expecting it for so long, it wasn't a great big deal. But of course, Dee Dee came over and got trashed on May's liquor. I went to the service they had for him. You could see his body sticking out of the casket. He looked just about the same dead as he did alive, except his mouth was molded into a smile. At the end, the whole family walked down the aisle behind the casket. It was on wheels. Randall stared straight ahead while Dee Dee bawled into his sleeve. Daisy came last. She looked over all the guests as if she had just taken her wedding vows and was counting up how many presents she was going to receive. She didn't seem too sad. I thought you were at least supposed to pretend to be mournful at funerals. When we got home from the church, I said, "Ma, how about you teach me some more dancing?" I wanted to do something cheerful. May turned on the radio, and she started 1-2-3-ing me. We were going along, waltzing. I remembered every step and didn't miss a beat. May spoke the words, "cha-cha-cha." She liked getting jazzy, when all of a sudden she saw a ghost. She saw Matt standing in the hall in his high, smart judgment. Her feet stopped working. She sank into the chair and started to cry. "Ma, don't cry. It's okay," I said, hardly patting her shoulder from behind. "Please don't cry, Ma." She cried while I stood gripping the back of the chair. With the bowling and her whiskey and Dee Dee, she sometimes forgot to miss Matt, but when she remembered him, there was no one else on earth for her. Perhaps I'm wrong, and she cried because she felt sorry for Dee Dee losing Mr. Foote, or she was recalling both her own husbands and how they left her. Since I'm not May, I can't be positive what she was thinking, but I'd say that most of all she was upset because Matt wrote her 2 postcards since he'd left for MIT in September. She had to make up details to tell people about how he sent her letters 3 times a week and how popular he was with girls. He took them to dances. He couldn't decide who to ask since they all wanted to go with him. She told about the clubs he belonged to. Don't ask her to say which ones. There were so many she couldn't remember. I heard her telling someone at church that pretty soon, if her rheumatism improved, she was going to go visit Matt for a special weekend they had for parents. That Matt had asked her if she could come out. He was sending her cash for the jumbo jet. After Mr. Foote's funeral, we didn't carouse for a while. Sometimes after we ate and the chickens were fed, the eggs wiped, I went into the night and stared up at the sky. I wondered if there was someone just like me on another planet, if they had a dry cleaners up there, and winter's coming on, and the symbol and myth of Jesus Christ. I wanted to find out what she did when her heart grew so heavy, not even lying smack on the ground relieved the terrible ache. Chapter 8. Still, those days were kind of like a honeymoon with May. We were just ourselves. We were in the mood to raise a little hell. That's a phrase Dee Dee uses twice a night. It doesn't really apply to us all that much, but we did bowl maybe 3-4 times a week. May and I had yellow vinyl bowling bags with our initials embossed under the handle, and I owned my own ball. It was a present from the Foots on my birthday. I can't quote you prices, but they aren't exactly cheap. It fit my fingers to perfection. I got the best feeling knocking all the pins down, and Artie always petted my curls in praise of what he called my sensational talent. He was an old guy, so I bowled far better than either he or his wife. "Sweetheart," he called to me, You are a terrific bowler. There ain't no doubt about that. You must have been born making strikes. I was queen at the town lanes, with my big old blackie ball and my thumb and fingers. I'd get crazy sensations when I stood up to take my turn. It must have been all the exhilaration because I was a natural expert that made thoughts and sayings fly through my brain. There I'd be with Blackie Ball, holding her up in front of me, looking at her like I'm worshiping. And what came to me was the sentence, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God." And I had to look at Blackie very hard for a few seconds, thinking about, "In the beginning was the Word." I love how extraordinary that sounds. Nothing in the world but one word, out in the blackness, not even stars. One word. Sometimes I felt so queer, as if I weren't standing on firm ground, to think of it all starting with a couple of letters. Everyone thought I was concentrating or saying a prayer when I stared and then brought my arm down smooth, letting her go, and wham, all the pins, all of them tumbling, and a second later, they're swept away. You do the damage, and bingo, it's gone. Bowling was a fantastic sport for my eyesight back then, because it made me focus on faraway objects. When I was mad at something, I said, "Seeing the pins fall. There goes Honey Creek. There goes Randall." After bowling one night, I got stuck in the car with Randall while May and Dee Dee went to buy gin at the liquor store. Randall tried to get me to hold hands with him. His hands were short and fat like lizard paws. "Not on your life, Randall," I said when he asked me. "Why not?" he said, leaving his mouth hanging wide open. We were both in the back seat. Naturally, he took up over half of it. I had to smash myself up to the window. I didn't want to be near him. I didn't want to smell him up close. I felt as if I were watching myself from way up near the ceiling light. I wasn't used to being in situations like this one. I heard myself sneer. "On account of I don't love you, Randall. I don't even like you." "A person don't have to be in love to hold hands," he said. "I've touched hundreds of girls. It don't mean I have to marry any of them." "Why don't you just go and touch one of your other 100 girlfriends then?" I mumbled. "If you ever mention the subject again, I'll make sure Ma never buys sour cream and onion potato chips." I didn't think about what I was saying. He made my dinner thrash around inside me. I couldn't stand the sight of him gripping his change purse. But after I spoke like a snide prom queen, my knees went shaky, and I felt a little sorry. But then again, I couldn't help thinking that if only Randall had been in my class in school, all the bullying would have gone to him. I had a nightmare that I ended up married to him, and all my babies were as big as full-grown Randall when they were born. Randall didn't speak to me after that. He turned his head away as if my presence disgusted him also. Besides bowling, we went for fish fries down at Johnny's on Friday nights. Johnny's had soft red paper that sticks off the wall, inviting you to pet it. May said I should keep my hands to myself. It was all you could eat on Friday nights for $3.99. May and I went down with Dee Dee and Randall and Daisy's younger sister Lou, and Lou's friends. We'd have a long, noisy table, everyone talking at the same time and grabbing for the onion rings and ketchup. None of the Foots had patience when it came to eating. I tried to sit far from Randall because he loved food so much, and because I was afraid he might grab my hand and squeeze it to spite me. Daisy didn't have a job, and probably spent all day being photographed on different kinds of vehicles. She was supposed to behave, stick around, seriously look for employment, and quit drinking as a part of her probation. The police had their eye on her every move because she stole and went driving around when she was smashed. She had hurt Mr. Kirk, a farmer with a wife and three children, so badly his arms and legs will never function. They couldn't absolutely prove it was Daisy's fault because no one saw the accident, and Mr. Kirk failed the breath test too. Still, she was not allowed to go out at night unless she was with family members. For me, Johnny's was the special event of the week. For Daisy, spending Friday nights in a greasy restaurant with her family was like being tortured mercilessly. She said, "It takes me a whole week to get the smell of this dump out of my hair." Sometimes she'd catch my eye and cock her head in the direction of the bar. She made my heart run and scramble just as it used to when I saw Miss Penn, my third grade teacher. We'd go stand at the bar and talk while everyone else sat in the next room. Daisy said, "How come you don't ever say nothing? And I just jabber away." She didn't give me time to answer. She said, "I wish everyone was like you. You know, friendly without always giving me the time of day." I know I blushed at the compliment before I continued to pant for more details. Daisy always described her favorite boyfriends and where they took her before she was on probation. She always made them drive her to fancy clubs and restaurants. Otherwise, she wouldn't bother to date them. Secretly, I was glad I wasn't a man of Daisy's, because she bossed them around and spent their money. They came home broke, wondering who she was going to go to next. She didn't ever mention a motorcycle to me, however. Daisy was either going to enroll in broadcasting school so she could be on the news, or beauty college. She couldn't decide which. "I think I'm a natural for communications," she said. But if she graduated a beautician, she told me she'd always do me up for free. She said I was lucky to have curls, but that a person had to show them to the best advantage. Her good taste made it possible for her to instantly say what could make a girl look beautiful. She tilted her head, inspecting my whole body. She made me feel like I was a frog, but that she could almost imagine the fairy princess if she whipped her brain into working overtime. She explained that at beauty college, she would learn to do stage makeup and facials, so she could go to New York and do makeup for ABC. Either that, or someone would be putting the makeup on her in New York before she went on the set for the evening news to describe the fires and the murders. When Dee Dee stuck her head in the bar to see if we had run off, Daisy gave her the cold stares, practicing, I suppose, for the looks she'd give the weatherman when he predicted snow and ice. Daisy told me about the classes she was supposed to attend where they teach you not to drink and drive at the same time. I bet she sat in the back row of the classroom with her arms folded, her feet on the seat in front of her, and stared the teacher down, letting him know she had never been subjected to such a boring human being in her entire life. I could see both Daisy and Dee Dee in one of the books Charles Dickens wrote, because sometimes it seemed as if they were larger than life, on top of the fact they were so greedy for trouble. Randall also could fit into the books perfectly. He could be the star boy in the schools Charles Dickens always has, where there are 200 scrawny, starved kids and one boy who is fat and greasy. That's Randall for you. Daisy is certainly beautiful, but she assumed she didn't have to do one thing. She would always look glamorous, and everyone would automatically love her for her looks alone. I did love her. I even worshipped her. But I knew she was no saint. She did hit-and-run accidents and thought nothing of it. She kept saying she was moving to Hollywood, California one minute, and then New York City the next, to do makeup for famous people, such as soap opera stars. And one of the actors would fall for her, and then they'd put her on TV. She said it would be a high-class program about police women stopping criminals. We had to laugh over that one. I didn't like to tell her, but sometimes I had the feeling Daisy and I were going to be bowling forever right in Stillwater. We'd probably have heart attacks when we were 85 down at the town lanes. On the first anniversary of our commencement from high school, May got word from Matt. He said he was planning to spend the summer out in Boston doing research. He wrote that he was sharing an apartment with a person named Virgil King. May looked up at me worried. She said, "Ain't that a jigaboo name?" I considered saying yes to see if Matt's high standing would plummet, but there was a chance May would walk straight into the kitchen and stab herself. So I said, "It's probably just one of them common names out there in Boston." My remark didn't comfort her any. She frowned, no doubt running over the list who she might call to ask what black people name their children. It would have to be someone who knew, but wouldn't wonder why May wanted such curious information. She hadn't seen Matt since Christmas, and that time doesn't count. He came home for 2 days in late December. He didn't spend more than an hour with us, because he had teachers in town he wanted to talk to. It didn't bother me that Matt wasn't coming back for the summer. I already figured I'd never see him again. It doesn't do one bit of good to say, "if only." But if that summer of 1974 hadn't happened to me, I know May and I would still be down at the Trim and Tidy, rubbing our noses from the odor, polishing up the bowling trophy I won for the team. It was the summer, in the month of July, when we, all of us, weren't ever going to be the same again. On a scorching night around Independence Day, we were restless and irritated by every noise and movement. Even the bugs seemed nervous due to the sultry weather. The mosquitoes buzzed extra loud in my ears. Daisy drove up in the truck when I wasn't doing anything but slouching on the porch. She had behaved herself and gotten her driving privileges back. She said she was going to go straight through the ceiling if she stayed in the house. It was too hot to do the usual activities she does with men, so she was staying miles away from temptations. She said she was going to melt down any minute. All that you'd see if Daisy melted would be a patch of green eyeshadow on the carpet. May was so upset about Matt staying in Boston that she didn't notice what I was up to. She fanned herself with a magazine and flicked her hand at us. She didn't care if we drove to Toledo and back. We went out into the night, Daisy and I, climbed into the Foots truck. Daisy revved the engine, and we bombed away. She had on lime green shorts with a halter top. Her perfect oval navel looked like someone yawning. Daisy laughed at me and said I looked like Miss Bailey, our ex-gym teacher, who always wore shorts past her knees. We got to giggling over what a dried-up homo she was. In fact, I was wearing some prehistoric shorts of May's and a blue T-shirt that didn't show my shape, just the kind of thing Miss Bailey wore every single day. We went over to the beach in Stillwater. There's a lake 2 miles outside of town where you pay 50 cents to get in, unless you wade in from the swamp, which is what Daisy and I did. That night, the full moon lit up a trail on the lake. I almost said out loud that it looked as if you could follow it and actually get somewhere, but I knew Daisy might push me over in the water for remarks of that sort. We didn't see too many people around because it was Tuesday, and because even the water looked hot. There was no relief. Probably everyone was at the movies just to feel cool air and to think about ice and snow and salt on the roads. We couldn't help noticing the orange wooden boats parked upside down on the beach, with their oars tucked away inside. There was something inviting about the line of boat ends touching the hot waves. Daisy went and tipped one of them over. That's how she could be, acting as if everything belonged to her. "How about a ride?" she said. She pushed the boat into the water and stuck one of her legs over the side. She kept telling me to hurry up. What was I waiting for? Hell's half acre to freeze solid? "Don't we wish, my friend," she said. "Come on, you Miss Bailey look-alike." "What are we going to do if we get caught?" I asked, standing in the water ankle deep with my sneakers on, trembling because she had called me my friend. Also, I didn't like tampering with things that weren't mine. "We'll get into trouble, but it ain't the worst thing that can happen to a person. It's better than roasting alive. They ain't gonna murder us for just borrowing a beat-up orange boat on a night when you can crack an egg in the water and it poaches. My armpits are soaking wet and stink worse than a piglet. Get in! I'm gonna shove off!" So we were out there in the water. I trailed my hands along while Daisy rowed. I stared up at the moon, wondering if the man on the moon was as sad as he looked. If I were the moon, all silver, lighting up the water, transforming the earth, I'd feel pretty great about myself. Since we didn't have a light on the boat, we couldn't see things as they were. There was an object in the middle of the lake that looked like an enormous piece of litter, as if a giant had wadded up his heavy-duty Kleenex and tossed it in the water. We couldn't figure out what it was. We were 100% sure it wasn't a fishing boat. Daisy, of course, insisted on checking it out. She'd make a much better spy than a broadcaster. She'd have to learn to whisper before her first mission, though. What we came alongside of, after we rowed out, was an ordinary inner tube. A man lay still in it, looking as if he had been drained of his blood for several weeks. We didn't say anything to him. He had his head resting on one side of the tube, and his legs flopped over the other. He didn't have a shirt on. We could see the ivory skin of his moist stomach and chest shining. He was wearing sopping wet blue jeans, and he had a six-pack tied with a string around the tube. His eyes were closed, and there was a stub of a cigarette hanging from his lips. There was something about him, the way he soaked up the beams, and how serene he was. You could just tell it, that made me want to get in with him, see how it felt. Daisy leaned out of the boat, squinting at him, and then she started to snicker. She took her oar and splashed him while she shouted, "Ding dong morning, ding dong morning." "Hi, Mr. Ruby," Daisy said sweetly when he shook his head in slow motion. The water didn't surprise him. He felt refreshed. He must have been very far away because he had to look around himself and blink and dunk his head back. Finally, he grinned at her, and she splashed him twice more. "You seen Mr. Party Face lately?" Daisy said to him. Turns out they were familiar with the same probation officers. I didn't register the conversation. Daisy did most of the talking without bothering to introduce us. I couldn't help staring at Ruby because he looked as if he lived in the water. The inner tube was home. He needed nothing to be happy except water, a few beers, some damp cigarettes, and the moon shining down, filling him with the pure light. "Don't all the fishes nibble your toes?" Daisy asked him. "Don't they eat them up for live bait?" "Yep," Ruby said, grinning at her, as if he didn't care if a snapping turtle came and bit his foot off. I wouldn't have been surprised if he had a smooth black seal's body under the water. if in a moment he pointed his nose in the air and let out a hoarse bark. Daisy didn't notice that Ruby was looking at me. He smiled. He asked me a couple of shy questions with his grin and the curve of his eyebrows. I didn't know what those questions were about, but I knew he was asking me. I don't know what he saw in my face. Maybe the moonlight made me look like Liz Taylor. I stared at him for more than 5 seconds until I couldn't stand it any longer, and I had to quick squint at the water. The little waves were giggling at my reeling heart. I studied his reflection because I knew it was going to disappear if I didn't watch it carefully. Don't ask me what Daisy talked about, because I didn't hear one word. Her loud voice was like a radio, too far off to pick up meaning. I only knew we were peaceful drifting in the water, and that after a while, she said we had to shove off, intimating that we had appointments to keep. Ruby stared at me with moonbeams on his teeth while we rowed away, making his incisors look like they were electrified. I could see him smiling, I was sure of it, until we got to shore. I didn't ask Daisy one question about him. I wanted to make him up from scratch, without one single fact. He was a waterman, that much I knew. Perhaps he was also an amphibian. I thought about how a person got cool on such a terrible night, in the water, without clothes. Daisy put the boat back without turning it upside down as we had found it, and she mentioned that I was so quiet we might just as well get loaded. We drank quite a few tequila drinks and watched Johnny Carson in the bar. I could tell he was wanting to recite dirty jokes. He kept making snide remarks to the movie star he was talking to and snickering into his chest. The liquor we drank made me want to hug something large, such as a continent. Daisy was flirting with the bartender, and so I sat squeezing the leather on my chair, feeling my empty arms growing heavier. 3 nights later, on league night, May came down with her quarterly headache. Matt was responsible for them. She knew he had made a new life for himself that was leading him directly into the fire. Perhaps she was wondering how she was going to commute from heaven to hell, if God issues passes so you can visit your children. She told me I should go bowling on account of league night. They'd need me to score, she said. I'll call Dee Dee and tell her to give you a ride. Even though she couldn't bowl to save her life, it mattered to her that we whipped the pants off all the teams in Stillwater. She celebrated seriously when Trim and Tidy destroyed the other teams. Dee Dee obeyed May's orders and picked me up. She told me about Randall's hemorrhoids on the way. Right there in the parking lot, when I got out of the car at Town Lanes, was the waterman, smoking and sniffing the air. Perhaps searching the skies for signs of intelligence. My heart took a trip down to my knees, paid vacation. I stood staring until Dee Dee said, "Are you froze to the car door?" I mumbled no and tripped over the curb. That was the night we were killing the Red Bell Market. I made strike after strike without sweating a drop. Artie kept saying, "Sweetheart, are you hot?" Everyone was waiting for me to have my turn to see if I could do it again. They were primed to whoop and stamp. All the checkout girls from the Red Bell looked genuinely glum, because there wasn't a chance in the world for them. Without May to bring our average down, our team had the possibility for greatness. After each strike, I turned around trying not to smile and walked coolly down to my seat. Then I couldn't help it. I beat on the table and flashed a smile at my friends. I knew I was doing a spectacular job. I'm crazy about bowling when I score off the charts. I was also noticing my waterman. Ruby. His name is a precious gem. He sat at the bar watching my every move. I know because I felt his gaze burning through my back when I stood at the line. He stared at me, only it wasn't like Randall's look, which made me sure he was going to eat me whole. Ruby stared as if he would never stop searching for my face, because he knew he would find something good there. He stared as if he was compelled to see me. Maybe he had never noticed magazine photos of beautiful people. I swear he admired the way I stood up to Bull, and with each turn I became more and more flamboyant. For him alone. I waltzed after I made points and hollered, trying to mimic Daisy. I knew I could score 300 forever if only he was there observing my form. In the 10th frame of the 3rd game, I cocked my head so I could see him out of the corner of my eye. He was gone. In my 2 shots, he had disappeared. I turned around and scanned the room. Then I rushed out to the bar and over to the vending machines. I no longer cared about smearing the Red Bell Market, and as I knocked my empty head against the payphone, I realized that with him gone, there was no reason for doing anything anymore. The shell of me slumped down on the yellow sofa until Artie came to fetch me for my turn. My streak was over. Although, we still won, hands down. I didn't see a sign of him for an entire week. I looked for him everywhere I went. I searched the aisles in the grocery store, knowing that if I ran into him, within an instant, my tongue would dislodge and moss would cover my brain. I wondered if he floated away because he didn't belong to anyone. He lived his life on rivers and lakes. There wasn't a minute when I didn't dream about his coming to find me. He had a silver boat glistening, even without moonshine, and we went sailing away. We had delicious fish to eat, boneless. Plus, we didn't ever get seasick, not once. Finally, we turned into swimming creatures and never came back to land. There weren't dry cleaners or chicken manure in the deep sea, and we communicated only by loving gestures. Then one day, when I was weighing a pile of filthy blankets, I looked up to see him, out of water, coming into trim and tidy. He stood at the door smiling at me, and I had to smile back, breathless with surprise, at his face in daylight. He stared and grinned, showing all his rotten teeth. Something woke up in me, something that was hiding, although it used to come alive in particular spots of Miss Finch's books, such as the one about Madame Bovary. Miss Finch never knew I ordered the tape from the library. She had told me once that it wasn't an appropriate book for me. I took it home and sweated through most of it. When Madame Emma was in the hotel with one of her men. She locked the door, and then her bathrobe fell away from her shoulders. And there she was, standing at the door with nothing on, her body calling out for what the man had. When I saw Ruby shifting back and forth on his feet, looking at me, I wished I had the bathrobe at my shoulders, that I could let it fall. All of a sudden, I longed to own a bathing suit that would barely cover me, and I desperately wanted Ruby to first slowly stroke the motorcycle I would, of course, be sitting on, and then he'd find me with his hands. He told me he had a sweater he needed clean because he had somewhere special to go. He made his speech deliberately. I could tell he had practiced saying the words. I weighed the sweater without checking the scale. I glanced up at him and looked at the ground, back and forth. Ruby has wide blue eyes that look straight at a person, and he doesn't blink all that much. He smiles to show off his crooked teeth, the dead and the living. His brown hair that day was plastered to his head, because he always wore a Cubs baseball hat. It's the team that doesn't ever win. But it was his eyes, reflecting the kindness, and his broad, steady smile that had me caught. He wasn't asking me questions. He was saying, "Here I am." When Ruby keeps his mouth shut, he's especially handsome. He isn't exactly devoted to his dentist. May at least sent us to the dentist every so often so we wouldn't have to have our teeth pulled. She restricted our sugar intake because she said not having her teeth spoiled her pleasure in just about everything. Ruby told me that when he was little, his father tied his front tooth to a doorknob, then closed the door. The tooth refused to budge, but a few months later, it turned black and died. I'm not sure if it's a true story, or if he got it from one of the Three Stooges movies. At Trim and Tidy, Ruby and I stared at each other, and time stopped. I kept thinking about water, how gently it lapped his inner tube, how peaceful we all were, Daisy talking almost quietly into the night. I shivered and had to look away, and then he said he had never seen a lady bowl so professional before. He was talking about me. I had to laugh because he complimented me just the way I liked to hear. When he came to pick up his sweater the next day, he said, all in a stream, "Do you want to go to the bar across the road for a drink after work?" He had to clear his throat and say it all again, so I could understand him. I had to grin to myself because Ruby swaggered so confidently with the clumsy shoes he wore. They had chunky wooden heels, but when he opened his mouth, you could tell his nerves were on edge. I knew that we were two humans, that's all. Two humans walking around blindly in the night.